It's 12:37. Dry and cool conditions will remain with us through tomorrow. A Canadian high pressure ridge over the Midwest will drift into Illinois tonight and into tomorrow. The result will be frost and freezing temperatures over much of the Midwest tomorrow morning, with a freeze warning in effect for Illinois, Indiana, and the eastern portions of Iowa and Missouri. Rain chances will increase at the end of the work week and into the weekend. High temperatures today will range from the upper 40s across southern Wisconsin to the mid-60s across southern Missouri. Low temperatures tonight will be in the upper 20s and low 30s across the Midwest. The forecast for East Central Illinois, a freeze warning in effect again overnight tonight and tomorrow morning across the WILL severe weather coverage area. This afternoon, sunny, the high 55, the wind from the north around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear and cold with widespread frost after midnight. Expect a low of 28, the wind out of the east from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny with a high of 62, a little warmer tomorrow, the wind from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, not as cool. We'll see a low in the mid-40s, the wind from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Friday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. We'll see a high in the low 60s, the wind from the south at 15 to 20 miles per hour. Friday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the low in the mid-50s. Saturday, showers and thunderstorms are likely. Look for a high in the low 70s. Saturday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the low will be in the low 60s. And Sunday, showers and thunderstorms are likely. Expect a high in the mid-70s. Temperatures across Illinois and Indiana at noon were in a narrow range, ranging from the upper 40s to the low 50s. Many locations reporting sunshine at the top of the hour. At Rockford, 51. At O'Hare, Bloomington, and Mattoon, 48 degrees. In Carbondale, it was 50. In South Bend, 49. Also 49 at Indianapolis. And in Lafayette and Terre Haute, 51 degrees. Willard Airport reported 50 degrees at the top of the hour. The sky sunny. The dew point 22. The relative humidity 33%. The wind out of the north at 9. The barometric pressure 30.27 and falling. And at 12:40, 51 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Author Scott Turow may be best known for writing Presumed Innocent, the 1990 box office hit starring Harrison Ford, as well as his other crime thrillers. But following his service on former Governor George Ryan's State Commission on Capital Punishment, he also became an outspoken advocate for abolishing the death penalty. It's for that work that the Illinois Innocence Project awarded Turow with this year's Defender of the Innocent Award. Illinois Public Radio's Amanda Vinicky spoke with Turow about how he went from having no opinion on the death penalty to believing it is unjust.
My 2 years on the Capital Punishment Commission made me look seriously at the question of what the death penalty was for and whether it really served those needs. And the short answer was it didn't. And I realized that we were never going to create a capital punishment system that reached only the so-called right cases without also sweeping in the wrong cases, the cases of the people who are factually innocent or in some ways the even more difficult instances of the people who get sentenced to death and in any comparative sense don't really deserve it. And so because I thought this was a system that would never operate properly, I became an opponent.
Despite having no stance on capital punishment prior to that time, in Presumed Innocent, the protagonist is a man who is, in a sense, falsely accused and could very well have been wrongfully convicted. Do you feel as if you had any, tendencies or while writing that book were able to sympathize with those who are wrongfully convicted?
Weirdly, when I wrote Presumed Innocent, I had an experience of having been accused by a court down in Florida of doing something that actually I had been instructed to do by the Department of Justice, and so it took me forever to get that straightened out. So, you know, I've been through that mill a little bit myself. You know, I think it took me a long time to realize, though, that the innocent clients that I represented, Alex Hernandez and the infamous Nicarico case, that they were not one in a million, but that in point of fact there are systemic failures that lead the innocent to be convicted far too often. You know, and those remain realities in this country.
There is some argument that the fate of low-income or indigent individuals in Illinois who become defendants on capital and what would have been capital cases might now be in a worse off position, given that when Illinois abolished the death penalty, it also abolished the capital litigation trust fund. So not enough money then for these individuals to hire expert witnesses or quality attorneys, DNA testing and such. Do you subscribe to the belief that that is a problem? Should something be done about that? Could it be even that the abolishment of capital punishment for some of these individuals could be worse off, and that there's less gravity given to their cases and they land a life in prison, still alive, but always behind bars?
I don't think there's any question that that is true. Justice Potter Stewart said long ago that death is different, and it concentrates the mind of the legal system in a way that a mere sentence of life in prison without parole does not. And to say the least, it is a gigantic injustice to sentence the innocent to any term imprisonment, let alone the rest of their lives. And yet, there's no way not to recognize the fact that the cause of justice has been hugely advanced in this state by the abolition of the death penalty. I don't mean to complain about it, but there's no doubt that we are paying less attention to cases that we should still be paying a great deal of attention to.
The Commission on Capital Punishment was not the only state commission that you served on. Ryan's successor, Rod Blagojevich, appointed you to the Executive Ethics Commission. Can you speak about your interactions with Blagojevich and your participation on that panel? And do you believe that it has the tools to root out and find wrongdoing within the executive branch? Or perhaps is the Blagojevich administration an example of faults within that system?
I always joke that, you know, I'm privileged to have been Rod Blagojevich's first ethics appointee, but I don't know Governor Blagojevich. I met him once before I was appointed and had no contact with him afterwards. In terms of the Executive Ethics Commission, I was privileged to serve with an extraordinary group of individuals on the commission, many of whom are still there. They do a great job. Probably the main achievement, with the unwitting aid of Governor Blagojevich, of my time on the commission, was to push for reform of the ethics legislation to remove the many trapdoors that were in the original bill that prevented effective enforcement of the ethics laws. And it's now a stronger bill, and the Ethics Commission, I'm sure, is doing an even more effective job.
Do you stand by the practice of keeping cases private, or does that leave for an opportunity for there to be any sort of internal corruption or collusion?
One of the significant changes that was made when the original ethics legislation was reformed was to provide for disclosure in cases where there's proven misconduct. We talked earlier in our conversation about the fact, though, that the justice system does not always function perfectly. A mere accusation against somebody is just that. And as much as I thought that the public ought to know about cases of proven misconduct, I was just as strong in believing that until those charges have been established, that it's inappropriate to besmirch somebody's name without a determination that there's clear evidence to support it, and I still feel that way.
Also, you were involved in the Operation Greylord prosecution. Illinois has this reputation for corruption, obviously going back to Graylord through Blagojevich. Just in general, what makes Illinois a place where these things can happen, or is this state no different than any other?
You know, I have kind of a contrarian theory about this, which is it is true that we've had a political culture for a long time, wherein Mike Royko's famous phrase, you know, the motto of Chicago really should be, "Where's mine?" But that's true of a lot of metropolitan areas, especially in the eastern half of the United States, and some states in the Southwest. We've also had extraordinarily effective law enforcement in the U.S. Attorney's offices here and in Chicago in particular over, you know, more than a generation. And a lot of our knowledge of public corruption comes because of the effectiveness of, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office and some of the state's attorneys. So I don't really think we're that much worse than everybody else. And part of it is just that we're better at proving it.
Author and attorney Scott Turow. He was awarded the Illinois Innocence Project's Defender of the Innocent Award Monday in Springfield. Turow spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Amanda Vinicky.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 11th of April, 2012. It was on this day, 1976, the first Apple computer came on the market. And a year later came the Apple II. It's the birthday of Marguerite de Navarre, born in Angoulême, France, 1492. She was the daughter of a count and a mother with high aspirations for her children, so Marguerite learned Latin, Spanish, Hebrew, and Italian. She read philosophy, read the scriptures. Her younger brother Francis became the king of France, and he'd always looked up to his big sister, so he asked her to join his court, and she did, and she advised him on all sorts of things, on diplomatic affairs, and why he should employ Leonardo da Vinci and Benvenuto Cellini at the royal court, and why he should try to reform the Catholic Church. She tried to mediate the religious conflict between Catholics and Protestants and to protect reformers like John Calvin, even though she didn't agree with him. It's the birthday of Dorothy Allison, born Greenville, South Carolina, 1949. Grew up desperately poor, but she was inspired by the confidence that her teachers and classmates had in her. She said, because they did not see poverty and hopelessness as a foregone conclusion for my life, I could begin to imagine other futures for myself. She was the first person in her family to go to college, and there in the late 60s, she was introduced to the feminist movement, which she said was like opening your eyes underwater. Wrote a memoir about her childhood and family history called Two or Three Things I Know for Sure, and wrote a novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, which she's best known for. Dorothy Allison, who said, people want biography, people want memoir. They want you to tell them that the story you're telling them is true. The thing I'm telling you is true, but it did not always happen to me. It's the birthday of the poet Mark Strand, born on Prince Edward Island, Canada, in 1934. It's the birthday of poet Christopher Smart, born in Shipbourne, England, 1722, who experienced a religious awakening that convinced him that he was a prophet, and he began praying and preaching in the streets of London and tried to follow the biblical injunction to pray ceaselessly, and he would drop to his knees whenever the Spirit moved him, which embarrassed his family, and they put him into an asylum, where he wrote the two poems for which he's best known, A Song to David and Jubilate Agno, which includes a section praising his cat. It's our poem for today, Christopher Smart. For I will consider my cat Jeffrey, for he is the servant of the living God, duly and daily serving him. For at the first glance of the glory of God in the east, he worships in his way. For is this done by wreathing his body 7 times round with elegant quickness? For he keeps the Lord's watch in the night against the adversary. For he is of the tribe of Tiger. For he purrs in thankfulness when God tells him he's a good cat. For he is an instrument for the children to learn benevolence upon. For every house is incomplete without him, and a blessing is lacking in the spirit. For he is the